Cliffcentral. The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. It's another week, another show. Ramon?
All is well. Jonathan, how's it going?
Yeah, look, as I always say, can't complain. Or nobody cares if I do, so let's carry on.
I wish others wouldn't complain either.
Yeah,
living
well,
in a better country.
There's a lot to complain about. We're actually collecting newspaper clippings for our end of month show.
Indeed. I think it's going to be a two-hour show with the amount of moronic statements we've seen lately.
Yeah, and some good news on upcoming guests, Gad Saad, which we've announced coming on the show,
and we'll be on his as well.
Yeah,
so we'll be experimenting with YouTube.
Yeah, that should be good fun and quite interesting, and looking forward to it.
Very much so. But as for today, we have a very very important guest.
Yeah, so probably our most high profile guest. To date, he's looking at me questioningly. Our guest is none other than Moletsi Mbeki, who's a journalist, a private business entrepreneur, and a political commentator, probably known to many of you. He authored the books Architects of Poverty, Why African Capitalism Needs Changing, and Advocates for Change, How to Overcome Africa's Challenges. And he's just released basically what is the third book in that sort of trilogy, A Manifesto for Social Change, which he wrote along with his niece, Nobantu Mbeki. He was just telling us off air that he's the social sort of commentator, the sociologist, and his niece is the economist. So brings together a nice combination. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
No, well, thank you so much for coming here, Mr. Mbeki. So if you could, very simply, which ideas are you trying to disseminate in your book?
Well, what we were faced with was the problem that we all South Africans are grappling with, which is the stagnation in our society. We have the highest unemployment in the world. We have very large levels of poverty. So we asked ourselves, what's the problem? What's causing all this? And what do we think needs to be done about this? So that was our simple message, our simple challenge that we posed to ourselves. Many people, of course, have dealt with this particular issue. So we thought, well, let's give it another shot. You never know how it will turn out.
Yeah, because there's a tendency for people to say, it's not good enough to just point out problems. You also need to point out solutions as well. I think that's a bit false. I mean, you can point out problems without needing a solution necessarily for it. But so you wrote this book in conjunction with your niece, who I understand is a lecturer in economics. And you yourself said you're a sociologist. So why employ the help of your, well, not maybe she helped you with the book or you helped her, who knows who the real author is, but why ask her to join you in writing this?
It was actually her idea. I was promoting Architects of Poverty, and Architects of Poverty was very popular with the university students. So I had to do many presentations to the students. And I had to find a way, I had to package a presentation that was interesting for the students, but succinct and to the point, because, you know, students don't have a lot of time in there, and they don't have a lot of patience either.
Yes.
So I developed a social structure of South Africa to explain how South Africa operates. So I came up with, and it had to be on one sheet of paper.
Right.
So not reams and reams of paper. So I worked out the social structure of South Africa. I identified five social classes as making up South Africa. And these are the people who control the political power, that I call the political elite. People who own the assets, the productive assets in our economy, the capitalists, which I call the economic elite, And then the workers who work in our industry, the blue-collar workers, that was the third category. And then I came up with a fourth category, which I call the underclass.
Hmm.
This is a huge number of our population who don't work, not in the formal economy anyway. And then the last one was independent professionals, your lawyers, doctors, engineers, broadcasters, who work
podcast
for
hosts.
Themselves, podcasters, who work for themselves. So those are the five. So when I showed Nobantu this, and I explained in this one sheet how these five social classes interact with one another, so she said, there's a book there. So I said, really? So she said, yeah, definitely. I can give you an outline of the book. So I said, okay, write the outline of the book. And within 2 days, she wrote the outline, and I passed it on to the publisher, which is Macmillan. And they said, okay, guys, go for it. That's how the book happened.
Yeah, and I think that's quite well illustrated in the book in terms of you literally illustrate the different classes and how they interact. You do mention that the ANC is almost at war with poor black people, who would be sort of the underclass. But you also point to the fact that they still get a lot of the vote from that group of people. How do you reconcile that sort of fact, that on one side they're against and they're fundamentally acting against their best interests, the best interests of those people, but at the same time they still receive overwhelming support from them?
Well, the ANC has done a lot for the poor in the country. I think when the ANC came into power, there was a social welfare program of sorts that the Nationalist Party government ran for example, for old age people, blacks over the age of 60. The ANC has expanded this to encompass probably a third of the population with child programs, disability programs. I think about 16 million people are on social welfare. So this is a huge intervention by the ANC government in support of the poor. However, it does not remove the poor from poverty. It does not change their social class position. And actually, it's like a band-aid in real terms. So they are grateful to the ANC for that. So they will vote for it. But at a local level, there's a lot of fighting between ANC local government, which is what we call service delivery. It's a generic term. So there is they are living in shanty towns, there's no water, there's no sewerage, and so on and so on. So at a national level, they get the support from the ANC government. At a local level, they are not getting their needs being met, or they feel their needs are not being met. And that's where the conflict happens. It has not yet happened at a national level.
Because you make the point in your book that 64% of ANC voters are unemployed. Yeah. And that's a staggering number of people.
It is. We were shocked when we saw it.
For people who are going to sort of debate that fact, you know, that statistical fact from the Statistician General?
No, that is from Ipsos.
Okay.
They are the one. They did in the last two general elections. After the elections, they conduct a big survey to find out who voted for whom, for which party. And then they do a whole analysis of their social status, their education levels, and so on.
So extrapolating from that, for example, do we know about the voters of other parties?
Yes,
in terms of employment? For example, I would assume the DA has the most employed voters.
Yes, the DA. Firstly, the voter profile of the DA is almost exactly the opposite of the voter profile of the ANC. Most of the voters for the DA have passed matric, and many of them have tertiary education level, and most of the DA voters are employed. Most of the ANC voters, as you point out, are not employed. Many of them have not completed high school. Only about 8%, for example, of ANC voters have tertiary qualifications, very small number. So that's the
yeah, there's a wide gulf between the two, which is it's a bit troubling, because I mean, if one is unemployed and votes for the same party 3-4 times in a row, why do you think they do that? Is it just based on they understand that progress is slow and that the ANC is the best party to give them what they need? Or is it a faith-based vote that the ANC is all I know and I will stick with them through thick and thin? I mean, we're talking about generalities here.
Yes, it's actually quite a complex picture. Yeah. A large number of ANC, of the poor in South Africa, are in the former homelands.
Yes.
So a big number of them are women. They are under the authority of traditional leaders, of chiefs and so on, who allocate land to them to build their homes and to farm if they can. And they are also quite traditional. They are strongly influenced by religion. So the churches are quite powerful towards this point. So it's a very traditional community. Now, the ANC is a traditional organization.
No, indeed.
It's been around for over 100 years. So people who are tradition-bound, aspects of that tradition is the ANC.
Right.
An element of that tradition.
So it has morphed into a cultural...
Yes.
a cultural space. Absolutely. The ANC. The ANC is not just political, that's a cultural movement.
It is.
For its voters.
And then it has these hugely high profile personalities like your Nelson Mandela's and so on. So it really has earned that space as one of... It's almost like the churches. They are,
yes,
the cultural building blocks of South Africa.
Indeed. So let's go back to that structure that you set out for us, that those five different classes, so to speak. You argue, if I read correctly, you argue that structure has been in place for centuries.
No. This is actually, aspects of it have been in place for centuries, but others are new. For example, the political elite... The political elite and the economic elite, the separation of these two classes only happened in 1994.
Yes.
Before 1994, they were one and the same.
Well, yeah, well the National Party was a highly crony political party. I mean, so people who were in politics also were in business at the same time, and they ensured regulations were there to keep, monopolies on the economy.
Yeah, the National Party were landowners. Many of them had farms, had commercial farms. Many of them were business people. So there was no separation between the political authorities and the entrepreneur and the business community, let me put it that way. In 1994, this separated. So that was a huge new development for South Africa, that really we are only beginning now to start to understand what the consequences of that separation are, and they are still evolving. One of the consequences, in fact, I had a meeting yesterday for breakfast with one of the richest men in South Africa. I won't tell you who, but he feels totally disempowered. Although he's a zillionaire, he feels that the government doesn't pay him any attention. He makes all sorts of suggestions about how to manage the economy, how to overcome poverty, how to solve the country, how to stop the country drifting into becoming another Venezuela and those kinds of things. He just gets tea and biscuits from the politicians, and they don't pay, and they carry on with their business. Now, in the days of the National Party would have paid a lot of attention to that because their own economic interests would have been affected.
Yeah, you talk about sort of Venezuela and Greece. You mentioned that in the book and hinted towards the potential for South Africa to kind of head in that direction. They're not listening to this gentleman you mentioned who you know, would be, I suppose, considered possibly white capital. They are listening to other people who they do consider to be in their best interests. Is that just, you know, tough for him? It's not his time, or is it in your opinion short-sighted not to be inclusive of everyone?
No, I don't think they are listening to any business people, black or white.
All right.
They're just carrying on doing their own thing, which is running the state and paying themselves very high salaries, and then some getting a little extra through the back door, which is called corruption. But generally, the politicians listen to themselves, and they listen to their constituencies. As long as the constituencies that they have vote for them, why should they change their policies?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to me. It's also with regarding to that vote, because I see, and you do mention, as I said earlier in the book, you know, that a lot of the voters vote for them regardless of whether they get anything out. Now, you've mentioned the local and national sort of discrepancies, but how long before there's some sort of awakening amongst certain of the sort of social classes that you've spoken about? I think we could argue, and we'll get into the middle class just now, but we could argue that the middle class are sort of awoken, as they would say on Twitter, that, you know, they're woke. There would be huge argument that they are, all around privilege and stuff, but it's a separate discussion. The real thing I'm wondering is those other classes that haven't sort of woken up to the corruption, the cronyism, all of the stuff that's happening. How far are we away from that happening, and what do you think then results?
Well, it has started happening. The breakup of COSATU reflects this awakening. COSATU has effectively broken in half into public sector unions, which are made up of people employed by the government, like the nurses, the teachers, other sections of the civil service, and the industrial unions who are led by the metal workers who stopped supporting the ANC. So that awakening has started, certainly, with the trade unions, COSATU has fractured already very, very deeply. The big business, I think they realize that they are faced with a serious potential problems in our society, in the politics, in the stability of the country, and they shift a lot of capital out of the country. That's one of the expression of their ways of recognizing the problem. Is they move capital out of the country because they feel their assets are not safe, so they are hedging. There was an article I was reading recently about how many multimillionaires have moved money out of South Africa to Mauritius, for example. I think they gave a figure of 3,200. These are very wealthy people who are buying homes in Mauritius, which then give them citizenship
and access to everything.
Yeah, and then you get countries like Portugal, Malta, doing the same thing. So that is an expression of a recognition that something is threatening to them, and something is threatening to their families, to their assets, and they feel uneasy. So there is that awakening. There are, of course, businesses which can't move. They can move some money, but if you own a platinum mine, well, your platinum mine is in South Africa, and you have to live and manage your risks and your challenges here in South Africa. You can't get out of it. So those are the dynamics. The students, again, are another category that is very clearly dissatisfied. They have their roads must fall, their fees must fall, and various other things must fall. So you are beginning to get a turmoil. And then the ANC itself, remember, the ANC has broken apart twice. Mm. First leading to the formation of Congress of the People,
Hope, yeah.
And then leading to the emergence of the economic freedom fighters. So there is the waking up, I think, is quite advanced, actually.
So Mr. Mbeki, I mean, we see waking up in terms of members of the public, businesses, students, but it does not seem waking up is happening in the ANC itself. Is there? Why do you believe that? What is the long-term goal of having Mr. Zuma as the president of the ANC? Other than, I only see short-term gain as a goal, so to speak. I don't see a long-term strategic outlook, despite all these feedback loops saying what you're doing is not helpful to people. So what do you think the ANC is playing? What game is it playing? Is it just there to take up as much resource as possible for itself? Or is there like a long-term strategic goal somewhere in the future?
Well, you know, the democratic parties in a democracy, let me say, they will tell you they have great strategies for the country, but actually their strategies are only five-year strategies. Is winning from one election to another election.
Politicians just want to stay in power.
Yeah, they want to stay in power, and their horizon is 5 years. It's the same with the ANC. It has a five-year horizon, i.e. we stay in power for 5 years, and let's do something that will make sure that happens. So we feed the poor as much as we can, since they voted us last time, so they can vote for us. But we can't send the whole economy into a tailspin, because then we will lose the election, because then we will not be able to finance the poor during these 5 years if we do like what Robert Mugabe did and destroy the productive sector of the economy. So they won't go as far as the Robert Mugabe, but they have these kind of short to medium term strategies. I wouldn't call them long term strategies, no.
Isn't some of, though, what the ANC does in terms of their sort of destructive nature? Because, you know, as our president says, they'll rule till Jesus comes. So if you truly believe that, and I would assume that on some level he at least believes that the ANC will rule in his whole lifetime, which is probably a fair estimation. Then doesn't that sort of give you free rein to kind of do as you please, because you know that no matter what you do, you'll stay in government?
Well, it does. You know, it does give you free rein. But also, I mean, the ANC has a huge sense of entitlement, irrespective of how long, or the ANC leadership anyway, promotes this sense of entitlement that it's a black party, the black people were oppressed for 350 years, and therefore it's their turn to eat, so to speak. So there are all those dynamics.
That word entitlement, that's been quite a controversial word. It was said by an economist, and he lost his job over it.
Oh, did he? Fortunately, I'm not employed by them.
you can expand it. And you've said a bit about it, but you want to talk about that a bit more, not as an insult, which people necessarily take it, but as how it holds us back.
Yeah, no, it's not really an insult, and it's not intended to be a denunciation. Like everybody else, I mean, if you go to the United Kingdom, people fought a war, let's say the Second World War. After the end of the Second World War, the first thing they did was throw out Winston Churchill, who was the prime minister who led them very ably to fight the war.
To victory.
But after, they then said the Conservatives got us into this problem, and we must be compensated. So the compensation for that they felt entitled to was, for example, the National Health Service. that was created in Britain after the Second World War was to compensate the population for the effort it put into defeating the Nazis. So being entitled is not necessarily a wrong thing, but it's entitled to what? And how do you get it? That's where the problem is.
All right, so if we say, you know, it's fair to say that every South African is entitled to decent shelter, you know, to live in a decent home, to be able to have a job. Those are all fair entitlements. There's nothing wrong with making those statements. It's how we get there.
Yes, it's how we get there.
Well, I mean, all those socioeconomic rights are in the Constitution.
Yes, they are
I mean, so you are,
We accept the entitlement as part of our rights.
I mean, even in the case called Grootboom, which is a constitutional court case on housing, the court said you are entitled to decent housing. Yeah. I mean, it was a bit misguided because they said only if the state can afford to, obviously, you know, give you housing. So, Mr. Mbeki, so you have identified quite a few problems with politics, business, people are very unsure. What solutions do you propose in the book, at least economically? You have proposed a few. Let's start.
Well, we haven't actually got any economic solutions because we feel that the fundamental driver of South Africa's problem is in the social structure, not in economic strategy or economics prescriptions. When the owners of capital lose control or are moved out of political control or have very little political say, there are differences between all this, but when they are deprived of political say, they feel insecure about their assets. And that is one of the fundamental problems of what happened in 1994. We didn't see it as a problem at the time because Mandela was a very accommodating president. He listened to everybody. He even visited Mrs. Verwoerd. So he was a very inclusive person and so although the owners of capital in South Africa lost a lot of political influence and political power, they didn't feel threatened during the Mandela era. And in any case, during that time, it was more like completing the constitutional negotiation, putting in place institutions like the Constitutional Court. The economic issues were not very prominent. Secondly, the removal of the sanctions allowed the South African economy to grow very quickly. And in that time, it grew. This is the so-called post-apartheid dividend that happened, which actually did happen. However, this was just the beginning. The point is that the owners of capital, having lost political power and being so removed from political power, started to feel insecure once the political period, the economic period, started to lock in the, you know, after the Mandela era. So the government had to address more and more. And then the infighting within the ANC over economic policy. If you recall, in the 90s was the beginning of the infighting between COSATU, the Communist Party, and the ANC leadership over growth, which was called GEAR, but growth something policy. So these started to come up to the fore. And then the ANC's Bible, which is the Freedom Charter, has a clause there about nationalizing the commanding heights of the economy. So in the disagreements within the ANC, this started to come to the surface. So the owners of capital were saying, hey, these guys could come for our companies and so on. So that's where the challenge lies, is how to reincorporate the owners of capital into the political decision-making environment in the country. That's one of the first issues.
So that's a potential solution. Can we just get your definition of who the owners of capital now are, because what it was in 1994 and what it is in 2016 are obviously different. And I know, you know, you created some waves, certainly at the Literary Festival where you launched your book. So who are the owners of capital in 2016 in South Africa?
Well, actually, it's a very interesting finding that we were very surprised to find out ourselves, the authors. We designed the social structure of South Africa, but we didn't have any numbers first, and we didn't have any race breakdown. So we went to see the statistician general to ask for help, because obviously he has all the information about the population in this country. He liked the challenge. He hadn't seen before a social structure like the one we had come up with. So he put his team to work to see how many people of what race and what have you belong to its social class. Anyway, if you look at the back of the book, there's a very detailed description, statistics about who belongs to what social class, is divided by race, is divided by so by income. So if you look at the statistician general concluded that the top elite in this country, whether they are political or economic, earn a minimum of 60,000 rands a month. That's the lowest. And then, of course, as we know, with the zillionaires, the mine CEO, mining company CEOs, they earn 40 million, you know. Sorry, it's 60,000 a month.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
It goes up to the sky. In that group, when you look at that group, he broke it down by race, and he broke it down by public and private sector. We were very surprised to see how big a number of black people are in that category. Okay, it's a very small class. Jointly, there are only 105,000 people who are in that income group.
Sure.
But a big number of them are black and a big number of them are white. If you look at the group earning over 60,000 a month, who are in the public sector, you have African, black African, 9,800, colored, 2,400, white, 7,900. This is the top end of in government, in the public sector, right, and in the parastatals. And they add up to 20,000. So out of 20,000, 7,000 are white, 7,900.
Okay.
If you go to the private sector, you have 27,000 who are black Africans. You have 6,000 who are colored, 4,600 who are Indian, Asian, and 46,000 who are white. So if you take the combined black population, which is African, colored, and Indian, you actually get about roughly 30,000, and you get 46,000 white. So there's a huge number of blacks who are actually very high income earners in the private sector. But you have a significant number of whites who are high income earners in the public sector. So when you look at the top elite in South Africa, they're actually racially integrated.
Well, that goes very much against the narrative, doesn't it?
It does go against the narrative, but that's the reality. I mean, I didn't work out those numbers. The statistician general worked out those numbers.
Yeah, and I think you know that will interfere with a lot of election campaigns.
Well, basically, we're saying white monopoly capital doesn't exist. Is that what we're saying? White capital
exists, but maybe not monopoly capital.
Well, you know, but if we have 30,000 blacks in the private sector earning over 60,000, then what do we call them? You know,
so monopoly capital.
So the You see, the language of South Africa, the vocabulary, is falling behind the reality.
Yeah, unfortunately, unfortunately, people look at things in a binary fashion.
Yeah,
it's either white monopoly capital, or it's either, you know, black people only, or it's white people only. It's never just the nuance. You know,
well,
the nuance
I got hammered by the blacks on Twitter, on social media, for saying the whites don't control the economy of South Africa, because they want to believe that they are being discriminated against, and therefore that the whites are still discriminating against them, and that the whites control the economy. So that's a comfortable narrative. The reality is the South African government controls the economy. It fixes the interest rates. It demands, if you make profit as a business person, how much profit you keep, how much the government takes that profit and gives it to whoever it likes. So that's how you control the economy, which is why when the rating agencies come here, they rate the government.
Indeed.
And its economic performance, because they are the people who control the economy. But I was very struck, and I didn't realize that was the response I was going to get when I made a comment. It was really a by-the-way comment that the whites don't control the economy or something.
Because it surprises me in that it's actually a good story to tell.
It is, you know, a good story.
Black,
this is
black,
one of,
black people are getting richer.
Jacobs, you should be an advisor to Jacob Zuma.
No, please no.
But you're showing
that. I think
that.
Cliff Central should get a new job as advisor to
Jacob Zuma. That'll be grand. But what the stats show is that black people are moving up in the economy. They're earning money. They participating in the economy where they weren't allowed to merely 20 years ago. I mean, it's a good story to tell, but some people say, oh no, how dare you say that? it's an odd thing to think that that the government has changed but the economy hasn't. That doesn't work well in my mind. Of course the economy has changed, and there's the stats to prove it. We're very big on data and facts on this podcast, and here's some more showing that the narrative
remains the old one.
Is completely wrong.
Mm. Yeah, the narrative is wrong. Mm. But many people like the wrong narrative, and there's a lot of education to do. And of course, one of the reasons why the wrong narrative is perpetuated is because they don't want to face the social class implications of this, because now if we no longer have racial exclusion, we have class exclusion, and those figures are showing the class exclusion. Yes, the blacks are in the top income earning brackets and so on, together with the whites and the Indians and the colors, but they are only that top group, 0.4% of the working age population. So it shows that the inequality in South Africa is very high. But the blacks are also in the top elite of this income inequality.
In
of
essence,
this
our
trust.
Obsession with race is becoming more and more irrational.
It's becoming more and more a cover-up of the class inequalities that have emerged in South Africa.
I wanted to ask, though, you did mention in the book a white tax. You mentioned that the TRC had spoken about it.
Oh yeah, Sam-Peter Blanche.
Yeah, and also Desmond Tutu has also mentioned it, not for the last few years, but he did a couple of years back mention it. Are you still in belief of any type of tax like that aimed specifically at white folk? And also, how, if you were, would you know, how would you advocate that based on a tax based on race and free market capitalism?
No, it wasn't me who advocated.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to get your stance on it.
No. I don't think that will solve our problems. So I didn't. I mentioned in the book that Sam-Peter Blanche, who's an eminent economist at Stellenbosch University, had come up with how to address, in the short term anyway, the problem of inequality and the problem of poverty inherited from the pre-94 era. So this is the proposal that he had put on the table. He felt it would go some way to, I don't think so myself, but that was his, but we were reporting on what he said.
All right, so if I may
butt in. So we've spoken about the elite classes, those earning over 60,000. Now let's look at the middle class, and I actually have the correct table in front of me this time. So in the public sector, there's a total of 20,000. So the data
you're still looking at the
one below that. So the data is between 11,500 a month and 60,000 a month. So that's the margins. So in the public sector, we have 550,000 black Africans and 108 white South Africans. So, and in the private sector, we have almost 700,000 black Africans and 600,000 white Africans. So in total, in the middle class, you have 1.25 million black Africans and 705,000 whites.
Which is still not in line with the exact demographics, but certainly a massive change.
But it's a huge change.
But the middle class in South Africa is predominantly black.
Yes.
Which is against the narrative once again.
Yeah, of course, which stands to reason. The black, blacks are 80%, I mean the black Africans, are 80% of the population.
Yeah.
So they would...
They should be represented in the economy, in those categories.
Yeah, unfortunately, what happens is in the underclass table is where you find the big difference.
Ten
million black Africans, 284,000 white Africans, about 900,000 coloured, and about 150,000 Indian Asians. So that 10 million underclass black Africans, that is where the real problem lies. And you argue that's been a permanent feature for a very long time.
Yes, that is really what migrant labor did for South Africa. The setting up of the mining industry, which is why you said before we started, we are saying nothing has changed in 300 years. The migrant labor system destroyed peasant agriculture. And that is the consequence of the destruction of peasant agriculture, is this 10 million underclass, because now they are totally out of the economy, they are not in any product. Whereas if we had retained peasant agriculture, they would still be producing for the market in peasant agriculture.
Right, but that's where property rights come into effect.
A whole multitude of issues come into effect.
But predominantly, these are the sort of people who are, you know, the state owns them in a way, because they don't actually give the land. They don't own the land on which they live.
Yes, they do. I noticed, though, a few days ago that King Zwelithini said that he's, you know, he's owner of the
Ingonyama
Trust, which controls nearly 3 million hectares in KZN, which is about 60% of all land in KZN. He said he's introducing a reform whereby the residential part will now be privately owned and titles will be issued to the owners so that they can get mortgages and so on. And somebody even mentioned that now Nkandla, the infamous Nkandla estate, will now really be privately owned, the land on which it stands. Not owned anymore by Ingonyama Trust. So there are changes that are happening there too.
Ramon talking about all these things that sort of open up the economy. And BEE has done absolutely nothing for that underclass of people. And you mentioned BEE in the book, and you I think the word you used was the kind of rabid adherence to BEE. I don't know if that is a correct quote, but you seem to be quite specific on your view on it. You can tell us about that.
Well, you know, BEE benefits the ANC politicians. They are the people who benefit from BEE, but they didn't design BEE. BEE was designed by the big corporations. In fact, it goes back to, I think, to the 1970s, to the setting up of the Eben Foundation by Anton Rupert and Harry Oppenheimer.
Absolutely.
And that was to help create the black middle class. That was the theory at the time, which was a buffer against the hordes, so to speak, between the hordes and the zillionaires at the top.
And they still support it.
But it got translated into today's BEE policies, that concept. And they did pressurize the National Party, for example, to change the Group Areas Act, and so on and so forth. So that's where that BEE, that's its history, where it comes from.
And what are the consequences of contemporary, you know, BEE legislation on people? For me, it's state capture is a big word, you know, bandied around these days. But this is one form of it. It's nepotism. You give, like, I do remember one stage, cabinet ministers had 50 directorships on different companies. Yeah. One person was the director of 50 different companies, or was on the board of 20 different companies. That's not broad-based.
No, it's not. No, it was never intended to be broad-based. It was intended to buy off. Remember, when the ANC came into power, it was made of these former prisoners, former refugees, former rebels from the townships and whatever, who had a very anti-capitalist sentiment. They saw the capitalists as having been collaborators with the apartheid regime and so on. So the capitalists thought to themselves, we have to do something about making friends with these guys. So they threw some money at them, and free money, by the way. So there aren't many people in this world who when free money is thrown at them, will run away from the money. The guys took the money.
Yeah.
There was a company called New Africa Investment Limited, NAIL, which was the free money, which was set up by Sanlam, Metropolitan Life, and IDC. And they took ANC leaders and made them shareholders. You didn't have to buy shares. You were given shares.
Yeah,
IDC gave you a loan to nominally buy those shares, but you didn't have to pay the loan back yourself. The company, which was Metropolitan Life, had to pay back the money to, not yourself, but you got the benefit. So it was a very smart kind of buying off.
So it was giving the carrot to people in power or who are about to come into power to leave the corporates alone.
Yes, that was essential. And it has worked, hasn't it?
Very much so.
Figures show that it has worked.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I mean, I don't know that.
But if you're in underclass, well, it doesn't work for you, but it has worked for those guys.
Yeah, so the underclass has been left behind in the dust.
Yeah.
Let's change tack a little bit. You mention and you talk about in the book and your niece, let's get her involved in this because she shouldn't be immune. I'm sure she can stand her own ground, though. But you mention our sort of alignment as a state with non-democratic regimes. And, you know, we also spoke earlier about the Constitution, and you almost treat it as a sacrosanct document, you know, it as a guiding sort of force in the country. But do you think it has that respect amongst politicians, amongst the majority of people? Certainly, it's a liberal document in a country which is quite conservative. So...
No, I don't think South Africa actually is conservative. I think South Africans are very conscious of justice and fairness. And the Constitution embodies all those issues of justice and fairness. And then its instruments, like the Constitutional Court, have lived up to it. I mean, if you had a survey of how many people wanted to retain the death sentence, you would probably find a huge number wanted to.
Yeah.
But the Constitutional Court said this form of punishment doesn't jibe with the Constitution, so it has to be abolished. There wasn't even one person who went out demonstrating against the Constitutional Court. So the Constitutional Court, that this is not a fair and a just form of punishment, and it was acceptable, and it is accepted by the population today. So I don't think the South African population is conservative. We have conservative elements, of course, like in all society. But on the whole, I think the population in South Africa is quite open-minded, is quite liberal-minded.
All right, and the sort of alignment you mentioned with non-democratic regimes.
No, but this is government.
So it wouldn't be the people. No, it wouldn't be the people.
Yes, I mean, our government protected Robert Mugabe, for example, in crushing the MDC, the opposition party. They supported him and turned a blind eye and compelled MDC to go into a coalition government with Mugabe.
And endorsed the election results, which we knew were very
clearly the judges who the government itself had sent there said this was not free and fair. But an ANC team went there and wrote a judgment that, don't worry about it, the people have spoken. That was the word they used, the government delegation.
Mm.
But, of course, the judicial officers who were sent there are independent, so they wrote a report, and the government tried for 20 years to cover up, to hide this report.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
this is part of a bigger problem, which is almost becoming louder on a daily basis, this opposition to the West, inverted commas, and this almost, to me, what appears to be an irrational hatred of countries like the USA. Why do we want to be best friends with Iran and Russia and enemies with America and the United Kingdom?
Well, you shouldn't forget that, you know, the Soviet Union armed the ANC.
Sure.
It trained a lot of ANC people. There were lots of communists in the ANC. They still are. Who love nationalization, who hates the West. Although they forget that actually communism is a Western invention too. Karl Marx was a German.
Yeah.
So there are all those dynamics that you have in South Africa. Yes, so you have a very influential group in the ANC, which is the Communist Party, which does not believe, it believes in its so-called vanguard party. It does not believe in being elected, which is why it is not standing for elections. It wants to, you know, to dictate to the people of South Africa rather than to stand up and be elected and compete with other parties. So these are all the dynamics that you have, which make up our politics. I mean, we saw yesterday or the day before in the response of our foreign ministry, the international.
Yeah, the terror alert. You've come under criticism for what did you say that upset so many people?
When? No, I didn't say anything about the terror alert. No, what upset people was what I had said before at Franschhoek, which was that the whites don't control the economy.
No, there's a new scandal on.
Oh, is there?
No. You said something about that. I'll try to find it. You said something about the U.S. terror alert. But where do you stand on that?
No, I'm saying that the you see now the government is tripping over itself. One arm of the government saying, don't pay any attention to what the Americans are saying. The other arm is saying, the Americans are our friends. We share security concerns together with them. So again, there are contradictory trends. So one has to be careful about generalizing, because this response shows the split already within the ANC, or the mis that one faction believes one thing, another one believes something else, and so.
But this is a maturing process. I mean, the ANC hasn't reached its final form, so to speak. It's always very difficult to be a liberation movement to morph into a political party. That takes a long time, and some parties never do. As we've seen in the rest of Africa, Mr. Nkrumah and all that, they never lasted long, Mr. I forgot his name in the Congo.
Mobutu. But,
yes. But it's a maturing process.
Absolutely. However,
do you think that we should have matured already? Maybe like 10 years ago? Or Or are we still finding, or is the ANC itself still finding its feet?
Well, you know, the ANC is an old party. It was set up in 1912, so it's more than 100 years old. So that's one advantage. The other advantage is that it spent 30 years in exile in other African countries, seeing what people like Nkrumah were doing, what Kenyatta and Kaunda and others, yeah, what they were doing. So there is no excuse for not knowing that, from not having learned from the experience in those countries.
So you would think that, you know, once your brother came into power, they should already have, you know, found their form and had a goal-orientated strategy, yeah, look, for decades.
Example, the so-called Triple Alliance. Now, how can you be both a government and an opposition at the same time? It just doesn't make logical sense. The Communist Party wants to nationalize the economy and do this, that, and the other, and not have elections, have a vanguard party of the Soviet model. Now, you have them in the government as allies of the ANC. Now, to an average person, this just shows confusion.
And even worse, giving those communists very, very high-profile jobs in the cabinet. Trade and industry, finance.
He does them off.
I mean, these are very important jobs, and you give them to people who still believe in the labor theory of value.
Yes, but, you know, Pravin Gordhan is opposing Jacob Zuma. So Jacob Zuma, you know, he's now regretting giving this communist this high-profile job. He's trying to get rid of him, but the financial markets won't let him. So, yeah.
It's an interesting point. And you mentioned in the book the consumption revolution. So we got a couple of minutes. Let's kind of end off there to talk about the consumption revolution. Yeah.
You see, where South Africa is with this massive underclass, our main focus has to be in investment, not the massive salaries that are being paid to the top of our society, and in promoting this consumption rather than investment. Mm. Consumption must come from creating employment. Mm. So from creating production and promoting production. So that is one of the huge problems of the economic policies of South Africa. This South African government's economic policies behave as if we are a developed country. Developed countries like Japan, US, UK, they have high consumption. Their economy is driven by high private consumption. Mm. But those people are hugely productive.
Yeah.
We have a low-skilled economy. Yes, they are employed and they are very highly skilled. So there's a huge surplus that they generate. So you can have a consumption-based and a consumption-driven economy. We're nowhere near that. And if you look at the Asian economies who understand this message, they are not consumption-driven. China is investment-driven. India is investment-driven. And that's what South Africa should be doing.
All right, so stop burning the cash that you don't really have.
Yes. That's why you then start borrowing.
All right, so... when is the blue-collar revolution that you speak of coming?
No, we didn't speak of a blue-collar. We spoke of an underclass revolution, not a blue-collar revolution.
I missed that. No, the blue-collars are appeased. They've got jobs already.
No, our revolution is an underclass revolution. Yeah. That's what we advocate.
And if it's coming, so is that part of, is that the EFF, for example?
The EFF is a middle-class party. So
they'll love to hear that.
What we advocated was that the underclass must form an alliance with the capitalists in order to grow the South African economy. That is really our proposal, if we can call it.
It would be great if we had a party that was unabashedly capitalist, a political party that was unabashedly capitalist. The slogan would be, "We want black people to be rich," or something like that. I think it would be a great addition.
But this underclass alliance with the capitalists would be.
Indeed.
Yeah, because its priority would be to create jobs and grow the economy, create more entrepreneurs who employ more people, and so on.
Well, I think if
but you can't really get a Donald Trump in South Africa, given our history. You can't know.
No, yeah. Well, I don't think he's capitalist anyway, but yeah, he's a bit of a crony.
Well, yeah, he's a crony capitalist, not really a true capitalist. Yeah.
No, he is a real capitalist.
But it would be good to have a grassroots capitalist party that goes to the underclass and says, we're just going to remove all the restrictions you have to be gainfully employed or to start your own business. You know, as people, the black economy, in terms of the black market economy, is actually quite... It's actually quite alive and well in this country, but we don't see it because they don't pay taxes, they're not registered, they're not.
Well, like
they don't
the do a whole lot of things. Industry,
indeed.
Or township economy. There's a good book written about that as well.
But these are not really underclass. When we're talking, is that.
You're talking about rural people in traditional areas.
Lots of those, and not township, but outside the township.
Yeah.
Because the shanty towns are not really in the township. They are outside the town. They are on the edge of the township.
Okay, so we must ensure that they participate in the economy. Otherwise, they will be the ones who come and
definitely
throw everyone out.
And I would if I were one of them. I would come and burn down this whole thing.
Yeah. No, I can't imagine.
Please do not take that literally. I think we've had enough burning down. Unfortunately, we've used our time up. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here, and thanks for the conversation.
Yeah, well, the pleasure is all ours. I mean, as Jonathan and I know, we've read the book. Very, very interesting, and it's got some data in it, which is extremely important in this narrative age of sentimentality. So do, you know, take a look at it. As I'm sure your perceptions will change about where we are.
Not just opinion based, but there's you know, actual facts and data to back it up. Whether you agree or disagree, that's fine. You can take your position. Mr. Mbeki, thank you very much for coming in today. Are you on Twitter? Not on Twitter. Probably better that way. I used to recommend people get on there, but I would highly recommend against it at the moment. You can obviously buy the book, available now.
Yes, the book is in the bookshops. Yes.
All right. So let's get that book on the shelves. Let's get it off the shelves and into your homes, because there's some real rubbish selling on the shelves as well. And this is worthy of your purchase. That's it for the week. A Manifesto for Social Change. Am I correct?
Yes, it's called A Manifesto for Social Change, How to Save South Africa.
Ah, there we go. All right, so A Manifesto for Social Change. That's it for the week. Ramon doesn't want to say anything more. Believe it or not, he's speechless. And has sinusitis. This is the Renegade Report. You can find us on Twitter at Renegade_report. You can find myself and Ramon there. I'm sure you know how to by now. Facebook, Renegade Report. Give us a like if you don't mind. If you're listening to this on iTunes, please rate us, and we will see you next time. Thanks so much for listening.
Cliffcentral.com.